Welcome to the Pathways to Heart podcast series presented by the Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning at Sophia University. Sophia University is located in California and offers students a unique educational experience rooted in transformative, transpersonal education. The Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning supports transformative education by creating engaged leaders and learners through resources, trainings, and events. This podcast series focuses on critical emerging issues in our communities. This podcast is a discussion with Dr. Robert Fraser. Dr. Fraser received his doctorate in social psychology from Harvard University in 1967. While studying there, he conducted research in Japan, studying Aikido with the founder of this martial art. He is the co-author of the textbook Personality and Personal Growth and is the author of many books on Sufi psychology and wisdom. In 1975, Dr. Fraser co-founded the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, now Sophia University, with Dr. James Fadiman. This was the first institute of higher education devoted exclusively to teaching transpersonal psychology. Here, Dr. Fraser shares his memories, thoughts, and insights on the evolution of transpersonal psychology as a discipline and the development of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. This podcast has been adapted from an interview conducted in May of 2023. He is interviewed by Dr. John Elfers. Welcome, Dr. Bob Fraser, and thank you for agreeing to share with us, you know, your historical perspective on the evolution of transpersonal psychology. So I'm going to turn it over to you to really reflect on what was it like in the beginning? Like, how did all this emerge?
Well, I remember years ago hearing Ramdas, who was a brilliant lecturer, and he said, I'll tell you my story, and that I think most teaching is telling our stories anyhow. Mm-hmm. And my story is I started thinking about transpersonal psychology when I was in Japan, you know, 5,000 miles away. And I met the founder of Aikido. Well, in fact, I read a book, one of the very first books in English on Aikido, and it had poetry he wrote about Aikido, and it had several pictures of him. And there was something powerful that I felt. And in fact, I was in Hawaii studying Japanese at the East-West Center. I had a two-year fellowship. And I said, wow, I need to study Aikido. This is what I've been looking for without knowing it. And then I went to Japan, and my very first day, that I got in at night. The next day I took a bus and found my way to the international Aikido headquarters. And he was there sitting with his son in a small room in the back of the office. And I had had a year of full-time Japanese. It was like 6 days a week. But still, as with anything, you know, speaking was slower than reading and writing. Mm-hmm. So I stumbled a lot, and they were patient with me. But I first said, I'm so honored to be here and able to study Aikido and to meet you. And, you know, I felt like I was, you know, in kindergarten or something. But he was wonderful, and he was very patient. And the more I met him, he would, O-sensei, which is what we called him, which is the best translation in English would be master. Mm-hmm. Sensei is the normal term for teacher, and it would be sort of honorable teacher or great teacher. And the more I met him, the more I was convinced that there was something extraordinary about him. And, you know, I remember reading in, what is it, the, there were those books of story, there were books of stories taken from other places. It was a reader that was out there, I can't remember the name, and almost every issue had the most extraordinary person I've ever met. And I said to myself, my God, I've met one of those, you know, sensei. I never thought I would. And what I realized was he was an extraordinary martial artist. He was, you know, he was acknowledged by many as the greatest martial artist in the 20th century in Japan. But I felt that wasn't it. You know, that was just something he did. But who he was what was important. There was something about his character, something about the deep-rooted spirituality that you could take his martial skills away, he'd still be a master. He'd still be, the essence of him would stand. And then I said to myself, of all the psychologists I've read and met, the only one that even had an idea, an inkling of this, was Abe Maslow. Because I had met Maslow. In fact, I was the chair of the visiting lecture committee for the Department of Social Relations at Harvard, which included sociology, anthropology, psychology. And I introduced him. You know, who, me, graduate student, no PhD, nothing. And I got to introduce some very famous people. And I listened to him, and he sounded like sort of an old wise uncle, you know, not a famous professor. And I thought, no wonder he's, you know, he's not as famous as he should be. Because when you talk like an old wise uncle, it doesn't fit with the academic sort of way of being and way of talking. But I really said, no, his ideas were extraordinary and nobody's taking them seriously. I mean, you could have a whole career on self-actualization. This, by the way, was back in 1964.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, I went to Japan in 64. And so I was in Japan for 2 years. Every day I trained for an hour or more, 7 days a week. And it just became part of my life. And, you know, I paid extra for Sundays, which in those days, the exchange rate was so good. It was like $3 for a month. And another thing I felt, and this was just from even reading the first Aikido book, was it had a better picture of masculinity than I'd heard before. I remember seeing there were ads for some bodybuilder, I forget who it was, and you know, he had huge biceps, and there was a little cartoon, and skinny guy with a pretty girl on his arm goes to the beach, and a bully who had big biceps kicked sand at him. Mm-hmm. And his enlightened response was to go get the weights and follow this guy's muscle building system. So he comes back to the beach and beats up the bully. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's the American model of being a man. You know, you either get beaten up or you become a bully yourself. And there wasn't a lot of space for anything else. And then, you know, years later, I read
Gillette and Moore. Right.
So I read Moore and Gillette, and they had a single book called King,
Warrior, Magician, Lover. That's the one I recall.
And then they had separate books on each of those. And they said we couldn't find a model for mature masculinity. So it was a struggle that we all have to deal with this struggle in the West. And I felt Aikido taught me. I said, my God, there's another option. You don't have to be a bully or be a victim. You can handle violence and conflict without descending to that level. And so I vowed to sort of study those sorts of people. And 2 years later, over 2 years later, I returned to the States and spent an academic year writing my dissertation and sort of got in under the deadline by the skin of my teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And my dissertation was about conformity in Japan, because I was a social psychologist. That was my training.
Yes.
And I used the ASH study, which is not relevant to transpersonal psychology particularly, but and then I taught for a year at Berkeley as a visiting lecturer, and I started meeting with people in the Bay Area who were interested in this field for which we didn't have a name.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Joe Camilla, who was at UC San Francisco. He had a very sophisticated, for those days, lab that could measure brainwave changes. And there was Eleanor Criswell, who taught at Sonoma State University, and she also taught yoga. And since I started teaching Aikido, I started the Aikido Club at Berkeley. I started the Aikido Club at Santa Cruz. Wherever I went, I started an Aikido Club. And as you know, I made Aikido required at Sophia.
Yes.
A certain amount of resistance.
Mm-hmm. Until
people got that it was actually more valuable than most other courses. And there was a guy named Bob Ornstein who wrote the book Psychology of Consciousness, which was an interesting, very respectful of quantitative measurement. So there were a whole group of us interested in something, you know, interested in studying self-actualizing people. Some came in through meditation. I mean, Joe Camilla really wanted to measure the effects of meditation on the brain. Others came in through a discipline like Eleanor Criswell with yoga and me with Aikido. And then there were some people came in through drugs. You know, that the experiences they had under one sort of drug or another let them see the world in such a powerfully different way.
Yeah.
That they wanted a psychology that talked about altered states of consciousness. And of course, that was our dear friend Charlie Tart.
Mm-hmm.
Who was a brilliant researcher, a very, very smart guy. But his way in was through marijuana and using other drugs. So we were a group of people in search of a title. You know, it sounds like a Broadway play.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we found out that there are people in Palo Alto who decided on the term transpersonal. And there's a whole discussion about that. How can you be beyond the personal, et cetera? But it's stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're left with an albatross around our neck in some ways, because my experience was ever since I founded ITP Sophia, nobody understood what we were doing unless they enrolled.
Mm-hmm.
Or there were faculty who were really pursuing in depth this field. And I remember we had a wonderful president, Tom Potterfield.
Potterfield, yes.
And he, you know, he'd been president of Velcro. He was a professor of marketing at the university. And he got a first-rate marketing firm. He hired them to develop PR for us and set us up for interviews, etc. And after some months, they fired us. I mean, they said, we can't do it. You change your name or we won't handle you.
Ah, interesting.
It's like, because it's as though you say, well, this is the Institute of Psychology.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? You know, it makes as much sense as a psychology as it does transpersonal for most people. So it's a huge problem, and we still haven't solved the elevator speech question. You know, how do you define the field in 5 minutes? I think we can. I think we have not put the hard intellectual work that we need to.
Yes.
And maybe here or somewhere else, I really want to talk about marketing, because we could do it. It's just we haven't. And part of that is people still have those fundamentally different approaches to the field. You have people that think drugs are important still.
Mm-hmm.
You have people who feel it's all about meditation and the states of meditation. You have other people who are deeply involved with some spiritual practice,
mm-hmm.
some life-transforming practice, including Jungian analysis and other things. And we don't agree in some ways, and I don't know that we've ever had that conversation to get to the bottom of those disagreements. But what's fascinating was once I started in 1975, I started the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. Over and over again, students said, this is the most profound 2 years I've ever spent in my life. This has transformed my life.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it every year with their graduation talks. And every year I say, well, why the hell don't you listen to it and get the best parts and make PR for the school? Because it still goes on and nobody, because you need those nuggets in perspective. You can't just say this is transpersonal psychology. You have to set up an orientation that the person can, in a way, learn to listen to what you have to say. Because when you talk from another perspective, generally people can't hear it. That's the famous talk about paradigm change, about paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
The conclusion was, you don't ever change anybody's mind. You just wait till the old paradigm folks die off.
Ah, yes.
You know, and I think that's the problem we have. There's a fundamental difference between transpersonal psychology and the other schools of psychology.
Do you think we're still kind of waiting for the rest of psychology to catch up so that we're kind of on the same page, essentially?
Well, I think much of the rest of psychology has, and I would argue that humanistic psychology has broadened and has for years included the transpersonal. For many
mm-hmm.
that simply call themselves humanistic, I think positive psychology covers much of the same field, except they're so addicted to quantitative methodology that they dismiss qualitative, which is amazingly primitive of them. I mean, we've known for years qualitative methodology is necessary to make sense out of numbers.
Yes.
And, you know, I think every dissertation includes interviews with subjects. You don't just have people fill out forms and take the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we need to do more. One of my attempts at defining transpersonal psychology has been, it's the only psychology, and this, of course, is a little too dismissive of the rest of the field, that's the only psychology that covers all of human experience.
Yes.
Behaviorism covers the experience of animals, and what can be measured very precisely in starting with learning theory. The clinical psychology looks primarily at what doesn't work. And again, positive psychology was really a reaction to that limited point of view. And my argument would be we deal with, on the one hand, traumas, pain, PTSD, and, you know, how do you deal with the pain in life? How do you help heal people?
Mm-hmm.
And on the other end is genius, creativity, spiritual experience. Why do people go to church every week for all their lives? Mm-hmm. And if you look at Freud, you'd never find an answer. Or the answer is they're neurotic. Whereas you read Jung, and Jung said that's part of life. Jung said we need something to believe in. I mean, Maslow said we need something to believe in that's greater than we are. Otherwise, it's like vitamin deficiency. You know, we become ill. You know, we don't attain full psychological health with something greater than, unless we have something greater than we are.
Yeah.
And we include all of it, which is quite extraordinary. I mean, somehow we've not, you know, if we just looked at peak experiences and drug highs and what's beyond the ego, which was a big part of transpersonal at the beginning, well, then it's another small field. Then it's another field with a small focus, whereas we're trying to look at all of human experience. And once you take the point of view that you need to be cognizant of the profound spiritual experiences that people have, that they don't always realize that they have, and even when people are suffering, there is still a soul. There is still what Jung called a higher self, a self with a capital S. Mm-hmm. And there's that core of health within every person. Now, people may be presenting, as you say in clinical psychology, they may be presenting as in great pain.
Yes.
It's traumatized. But that within all that, there's a core of health.
You know, I've often heard you in this distinction about transpersonal from, you know, mainstream psychology. Often heard you make the reference to the fact that transpersonal psychology makes different assumptions about human nature. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? It's always stuck with me.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that's, I think if we're going to communicate, we have to talk about the assumptions. Mm-hmm. We can't just say it's a psychology that's bigger than everybody else, because people will dismiss it or won't get it. So some of the assumptions are, and I generally go to Jung for this, that there, in every psyche, there's an ego, which is the sort of archetype, the core of conscious experience. It has to do with the will. It has to do with immediate consciousness of the world around us, of the world inside us. But there's also the self, which is the archetype of the whole psyche and goes beyond the individual psyche, that in some real way, there's a part of us that's greater than we are, that's in touch with the universe. And every mystic talks about it. Even half mystics talk about it. That's how powerful it is. I mean, what's extraordinary is how often people in their journals, in their writings, and in their speech talk about these extraordinary experiences. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a resistance because the culture doesn't admit them as being normal.
Yeah, and isn't it true that, you know, even Jung is still not considered mainstream? You know, he is still a little marginalized. He's, of course, taken up in depth psychology and others. So, yeah, we still have, you know, some redeeming to do there. I'm wondering, so Maslow was a key influence on you and Jung. Are there any others you can identify? Like, who were some of the, you know, maybe standouts who, you know, helped you along your journey of understanding?
Well, when I was still a graduate student at Harvard working on my dissertation, I was teaching assistant for Eric Erickson for one quarter. I was a teaching assistant for the introduction to social relations with Roger Brown, who is a brilliant psychologist and psycholinguist, and a whole teaching staff that worked with Roger. And it was, I offered a course called, I forget what was the title, but you know, I had this idea for the transpersonal, but I knew I didn't have the language yet. So it was something about ways of thinking of Eastern peoples or something. I focused on the East because in a way it's from cultures that aren't afraid of spirituality. And I had a wonderful time. The students, I had mostly seniors, undergraduates at Harvard, and we fasted together. I brought in some outside teachers, and I continued that course when I taught at Berkeley, and then I continued the same course when I taught at UC Santa Cruz. And at UC Santa Cruz, it was the most popular course on campus. There was no room big enough, so they had to use a dining room for my class.
Wow.
So it was fascinating because the faculty were scared of it. The students loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And guess who won? Guess who's not a tenured professor at UC Santa Cruz?
Yes.
And I had a colleague who was, I mean, he was very friendly. He was a very sweet man. He was a chair of the economics department. And he was interested in these things somewhat. And he said to me, well, I understand you're having people chant and bring in a Buddhist nun. And he said, you have to understand that that's beyond what we should be doing in class.
Wow.
You know, and that he used a particular term that'll come to me in a minute. It may have been something like inspiration. And he said, you know, you don't want that. And you know, it turns out if you look at the roots of that, it was to breathe in that the divine.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, but that was bad.
Yes.
And when I brought in my Zen master to do a weekend workshop, and that was okay, and I knew how to fill out the papers, but then I got a letter from the sort of central administration building that said, you know, your Zen teacher cannot teach Zen. She can only teach about Zen. And God forbid they should have an inspired experience that would violate the state, the whole separation of church and state, which America is built on.
Yes.
And my friend, my Zen master friend said, please, can you give that to me so I can take it home? I mean, that it's such an obvious, again, it's a fear response. And, you know, I was at Harvard when Leary and Alpert were there. I knew them both mm-hmm. not really well. And Harvard had this insane reaction. The same thing. It was the culture.
Mm-hmm.
How dare you have people have experience beyond what is, quote, normal? And they said, well, you're endangering people. You're endangering undergraduates. And I thought, wait a minute. Anthropologists bring students into the jungle. Nobody says, don't do that.
Yeah.
It's fine. If you're going to do field work, that's part of it. But it's not like they're so consistent about wanting to have safe experience for undergraduate. But this was absolutely, you know, forbidden. And Leary, who was out of it a lot, somehow didn't file his grades on time. And I think the day after grades were due, they fired him because that was part of the contract. So as soon as they do that, boom, out. Similar to Alpert, he had an undergraduate take psilocybin or LSD. Before, they'd done it with students at Harvard Divinity School, who said they finally had a real religious experience, which they never had before. They gave it to prisoners in the local prison. The recidivism rate was down by a huge percentage.
Mm-hmm.
But they Alpert included one undergraduate in an LSD session, and that was it. Because our business is to protect undergraduates, especially because their daddies have money.
Yes.
So, but I think there is this, and it's an unconscious backlash. It's not like people are saying, well, this is, you know, beyond our assumptions about what people should be. Our assumption is that we have a huge range of possible human experiences. And I remember, and I in the Psychology of Consciousness, Bob Ornstein talked about human experience in a way like an electromagnetic scale, or the scale that includes, goes from infrared to ultraviolet, you know, much of which is beyond our conscious perception. What's beyond our eyes' ability to see without instruments. And he says exactly like that. We have other experiences beyond what, you know, we normally can see or feel or whatever, and that's part of being human. So that would be a major assumption that we make in transpersonal.
I'm wondering if I could get you to reflect a little bit on the initial origins of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. So you've talked about the origins of the discipline, but could you reflect on sort of what went into your understanding that this required a different way of teaching and education? And I know in transpersonal, in ITP, in Sophia, we pride ourselves on, you know, we talk about teaching for transformation, the whole person. We talk about multiple ways of knowing. How did all that come about? you intuited something and really started something new. Can you reflect on that a little bit?
Well, intuitive hell, I practiced something. it wasn't intuition in a way. Several things happened. One is, I trained in Aikido 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. And the training was so intense in the early months, I would want to quit after 15 or 20 minutes. And I said, well, I put this much pain and agony in, I'm going to stay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stay with it until the end of class. And finally, I got in good enough shape that I could train full out for an hour. But training that hard, meeting O-sensei, and actually taking falls for O-sensei, serving as his training partner, were all part of my understanding the power of the body. And I continued. I mean, Aikido was just part of my life, and it wasn't 7 days a week because I wasn't living close to the international headquarters in Tokyo, but it was 3 to 5 days a week minimum. And I hate to say this, but I'm going to say it anyhow. Before, everything looked normal at Harvard. Professors were walking around carrying their briefcases and pontificating about whatever they wanted to pontificate about. And I came back from Japan and I noticed there were heads carried by bodies. Mm. The body was like a donkey that carried around, you know, somebody too poor to have a horse. You know, that this is what counts. This is my thinking head. This is where I write books from. This is where I lecture from. And I don't care about this. And I said, there's something so imbalanced about this, so wrong, that I started studying Reichian psychology. Actually, was in Reichian therapy, focused on breathing and my body for 2 years. I was in Jungian therapy for a couple of years, maybe 3 years. And again, I got this sense of looking at dreams from this very powerful archetypal perspective, that a symbol can really mean the world, not just some tiny little something to play with intellectually. Mm-hmm. And I started meditating in Japan. One of my friends, American friends, who was training in Aikido with me, said, you loan me his copy of the Autobiography of a Yogi by Yogananda. And I was blown away, because this was a brilliant introduction to the life of spirit. And they started sending me lessons. And the funny thing is, and this is, I think, how this business works, and I can easily switch hats and put on my Sufi teacher hat, but you need to ask for that. Mm-hmm. So every week I was getting a little package of mimeographed excerpts from Yogananda's years of lecturing and writing that also introduced me to meditation, which I started practicing again every day. And that became a critical part of my life. So there was meditation, the life of spirit. There was the life of the body in Aikido. And there was this whole integration, in some sense, that Jung brought in. And he actually, Jung had more interest in the body, I found out years later, than most people knew, that he worked with deep relaxation therapists and body therapists, and it wasn't only the head for Jung. So I had these things going. And as I said, I taught for 7 years at UC, first a year at Berkeley, and then 6 years at Santa Cruz. And in my course on psychology of religion, I brought in spiritual teachers. I brought in my Zen Buddhist friend. I brought in a wonderful yoga guru. I brought in Christian mystics. I kept finding fascinating people. I brought in a wonderful man named Brother Antoninus, who was a lay brother in the Dominican order, and who was also a very famous beat poet before that. And he wrote, as only a poet can, about what it's like to experience God. You know, and he was using a phrase like, I was as a woman before God, and God penetrated me. And he's really sort of on the edge, but in a way, he's echoing in this incredibly powerful way what the mystics have written about for years. So I had these, I learned from these wonderful teachers as well. And I noticed in myself how these different things impacted me in different ways, but there was also a synergy among them, that meditation really made my Aikido better, and Aikido made my meditation better, and, you know, understanding the writings about spirit in Jung and others, you know, enhanced my understanding. And I had this funny notion that we all resist growth in different ways, so let's hit them at different points. Let's hit them physically, let's hit them spiritually, let's hit them intellectually. And there was a point in which I made a list of the things that we were doing in the human potential movement, because I began to go to conferences as well. And so there were people doing courses on somatics in various ways. There were people doing group process, which again was life-changing, the emotional work. There was brilliant theorizing. There were people talking about meditation and different kinds of meditation. And so I said, it's got to be holistic, you know, partly because if you do, you know, because I read Gurdjieff and others who said the resistance piles up if you just push in one direction. So you've got to get at people from different directions. And I found it was very true. That they would get all uptight in resistance, and bam, I brought in a teacher or reading or something that got past that. And that's why I think all these years the school has been that transformative.
Yeah, well, you really hit on a lot of those ideas early, and I think that was we're still maybe kind of validating those. I'm wondering, I hear so many people talk about, one of the things about transpersonal or their experience at ITP is the sense of community. And I'm wondering how much of that was really deliberate. Did you really try to foster community, or was it a byproduct, or did it happen organically? How did that evolve? I'm curious.
Well, I started, as I was making a list of disciplines, and I said, God, this is like body, mind, and spirit. You know, this is the roots of Western education from the Greeks. And then the students started adding things. I resisted a little, but they outvoted me. So somebody mentioned community. I said, you're absolutely right. We haven't dealt with that. Someone said, you've got to split intellectual and emotional.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have body, intellectual, emotional, community, and spirit. Five. And then some years later, we had an incredible faculty member who, Jill Mellick, who you knew, I'm sure. And, she started teaching the dissertation phase, and she would say to students out of her Jungian orientation, of course you're struggling, because this is the hero's journey for you writing your dissertation. And look on it as you're going to face a series of obstacles and guardians at each stage, as in a myth. Mm-hmm. And they went, wow, I'm not neurotic. I'm on a hero's journey. And, I mean, Jill was wonderful. I mean, she had a wonderful Jungian orientation. She had been ordained as a Swami in India. And she said to us, that's also gone dead for me. It's not working for me. And what I found at this point works is art. She was a pianist. She was an artist. And she said, we need creative expression. That's the thing we've left out. And we all went, whoa. And she later said, I thought people were going to argue. I thought they would just throw me out of the room. Everybody agreed. So we added creative expression.
Yeah, and then so that's the six domains, and
yeah.
All the multiple ways of knowing, which of course was part of the curriculum.
Let me mention before I forget, transpersonal really started at Esalen, interestingly enough. Nobody knows this, so
okay.
Look up, everybody. Esalen invited Maslow and a series of humanistic psychologists, you know, who had powerful workshops, and it was sort of the in force in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And they invited him to Esalen to meet with a group of ministers and priests who did spiritual guidance. And these were people who spent years guiding people in meditation retreats, in which they would meet with a guide every day of a 5-day meditation retreat and talk about what they experienced and what was exciting and what was frustrating, etc. And the psychologist said at the end of it, they know more about the human psyche than we do.
Wow.
Wait a minute, there's something here. We had the humanistic, this is the transhumanistic. Now, this is really looking at a larger perspective of human nature. So it really, strangely enough, and it's interesting that we don't refer to this as part of our roots, it was the very real knowing and understanding that came from people who a good part of their lives were working as spiritual therapists, if you will, working as spiritual guides.
And they were outside the mainstream discipline. And yeah, maybe there's kind of that message there too. Yeah, it's an interesting story. I had not heard that. It's very telling.
Well, formally I studied spiritual guidance. It was a 3-year program, and I got out of 1 year because I said, I know psychology, forget it. And so it was a 2-year program.
Mm-hmm.
And they were wonderful people. I mean, and they most of our faculty were priests and nuns or ex-priests or whatever. And I ended up taking as my spiritual guide Sister Mary Ann Schofield, who is like an 85-year-old Catholic nun. And talk about different life experience than mine. But she was incredible. Sometimes I walked out of her office as though I was walking on clouds. You know, I would say something about a spiritual experience, and she'd lean in and say, tell me about it. Where was it in your body? What did it feel like? I mean, it was, she was so activated by any hint of the experience of God in my life.
I want to acknowledge the time. We just have another minute or two. Is there anything by way of reflection, you want to say that we haven't discussed or you'd like to add here?
And sure. Well, I think one of the thoughts I had at the beginning, and this came from immersing myself in Aikido for years, was the difference between the workshops, the humanistic workshops in which people, you know, take their clothes off, go into the hot baths at Esalen, you know, do all kinds of things that are very exciting, if they're a high. You know, it's what Maslow talked about. It's like a peak experience, and then you go down. Mm-hmm. And later, Maslow talked about plateau experiences, where you stay at a certain level. And I said the difference between the model out there from the growth centers and what we're talking about in the transpersonal is discipline. You need to spend years at meditation or, you know, any kind of transformative discipline. It's not a big wow weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, again, one of the presumptions of our field, mm-hmm. is that it's long-term work.
Yeah.
And it's not, it wasn't in that version of humanistic psychology. I think that's, you know, that's one of our paradigmatic, mm-hmm. assumptions, that, you know, it's not fast. In fact, there's a wonderful saying in the Sufi tradition that practicing Sufism is like chewing an iron peanut. You know, it's like your teeth will go before the peanut goes anywhere. That's how long it feels to take.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important. And we're in a culture that likes quick fixes. You know, somebody gave an enlightenment workshop, which was 2 weekends. At least it was better than one.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of guaranteed enlightenment, 2 weekends. Your money back guarantee. It's like we do that. We commodify things. And
yeah.
I think to say, you know, that real growth takes long-term. Well, it always does. I mean, you don't expect a nuclear scientist to be produced overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Years of study. You don't even expect an athlete,
mm-hmm.
suddenly jump out of the stands and say, let me be your quarterback. You know, it's at a high school level, college level, pro level, and they're all really very different. But it's incredible amount of work. And I've seen how high school kids, every day they're doing practice and they're doing weights or,
mm-hmm.
you know, it is long-term discipline. And that's the only way I think that you get real growth in some areas.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
For more podcasts or information on educational programs at Sophia University, go to www.sophia.edu. Thank you for listening.